This podcast is brought to you by Squarespace. Squarespace is the all-in-one platform for online success that helps you build the perfect website to make your business stand out. Whether you're starting a passion project or managing a growing brand, Squarespace makes it easy for you to create beautiful websites, engage with your audience, and sell anything from products to content to time, all in one place on your terms. Unless you're a pro coding design wizard, and confession time, I'm very much not, making a quality, good-looking website can feel like one of the hardest bits of business. That's why Squarespace is here to help you every step of the way, providing fully customizable professional layouts and templates to choose from. It can also take care of those fiddly bits like device optimization, paywalls, and invoicing. So if, like me, you're more at home with manuscripts than JavaScript, Squarespace is the tool for you. Head to squarespace.com/history10 for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, use offer code history10, that's history10, to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. The uniform tramping of boots disturbs the quiet stone halls of Westminster Palace. Seven men in armour stride through brightly painted chambers, unnerved by the echoes of their own clanking armour. Steel mail covers their arms and legs. It clinks with each heavy step they take. The swords by their sides rattle against their thighs. They exchange worried glances, trying to reassure each other they're doing the right thing. They're tense, and not just because they're in battle gear. It's the occasion that's getting to them. They all know that what they're about to attempt is dangerous. There may be no turning back. But the way they see it, they have no choice. From somewhere far away, outside the palace walls, they can just make out the plaintive cries of ordinary English men and women and the whines of miserable children. It's the spring of 1258, and thanks to awful weather that ruined last year's harvest, the whole country is in the grip of a terrible famine. People are literally starving to death. Others are surviving only by hanging round places like this palace and waiting for daily charity handouts. Their groans and wails are a reminder to these nobles of why they're here. Before long, they reach their destination, Westminster Hall. It's the biggest and one of the most important rooms in the palace, where great lords do business with the king. These men know it well. But none of them have come here like this before, in armour, as though they're trying to take the place by storm. When they get to the doors of the hall, they all unsheathe their swords. Then they lay them down. They brought them as a symbol of intent. They don't intend to use them. Yet. Even without their swords, when the seven men walk into Westminster Hall, there's a hush. People clued into politics have been fearing something like this will happen for a while. A parliament has been going on in Westminster, and there's been plenty of rumours about the king facing a challenge from a faction of barons. But now it's actually happening, it's still a shock. Because this is very much a Magnificent Seven. They're led by Roger Bigod, the Earl of Norfolk, and one of the most powerful men in the land. There's also the Earl of Gloucester, and next to him, Peter of Savoy, who's now the leader of the group of the Queen's relatives known as the Savoyards. Right in the thick of things is a very famous figure indeed. It's Simon de Montfort, Earl of Leicester, one of the most charismatic but unpredictable men in the country. This is a group you really don't want to tangle with. The armoured nobles look around the hall. They see lots of worried faces, but not the one they're after. King Henry III the Plantagenet King of England, is somewhere else in the palace. Servants scurry off to get him. Eventually, Henry comes down to the hall. He sees the seven nobles standing, waiting for him, dressed up as though they're about to jump into the thick of a tournament melee, and realises something is very wrong. Henry isn't the most politically astute guy in the world, but even he can tell that trouble is afoot. The armoured men, with a theatrical flourish, bow and show him the respect he deserves as their king. But Henry is now full on quivering. He's always hated confrontation, and he's never had much luck in battle. The only words he can squeak out are, "What's this, my lords? Am I, poor wretch, your prisoner?" "No, sir," say the lords, "you're not our prisoner. But unless you get your act together, you might just be." They tell him that they want him to come with them to Westminster Abbey, to Henry's beloved brand new shrine of Edward the Confessor. There, he's going to swear a holy oath to obey their advice to reform his kingdom and sort out his mistakes. Otherwise, in a matter of days, they'll have thousands more armoured men at their backs in a full rebellion. But before they make their way over to the Abbey, they read out a list of all the dumb things Henry has done which have got him to this sorry point. It's a long list because Henry III, for all that he's a good guy, has been on the throne for nearly 42 years, and in that time, he's done a heck of a lot of dumb things. No one really wants to get rid of him, but this is a crisis. With a king like Henry, there's only so much of the madness you can take. And now his people have decided they've finally had enough. I'm Dan Jones, and from Sony Music Entertainment, this is History. Season 4 of A Dynasty to Die For. Episode 5. The Magnificent Seven. When Henry III chose his royal advisers, he ended up with some very untrustworthy power grabbers, which led to poor management decisions, rebellions, and at least one person in prison. Why didn't he use Indeed? Well, Indeed wasn't around back then, but it is today. Indeed is the ultimate hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and matching technology that helps you find quality candidates fast. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. When I was hiring, I didn't use Indeed either, and the process was very slow and stressful, so I wish I had. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a £100 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/dynasty. Indeed.com/dynasty. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Last time we caught up with Henry, on the last episode of this podcast, it was 1250, and he was doing something very un-Henry-ish. He was taking the cross and swearing to go on a crusade. That didn't seem like the finest idea he'd ever had, given his general kingly skill set and track record in war. But points for effort, I guess. And in the heat of the moment of 1250, kind of made sense. Back then, crusade fever was sweeping across Europe. Henry's hardcore little brother Richard had already been on one, as had Simon de Montfort. Then the French king Louis IX went off on one too. Louis took a bunch of crusaders, including some Englishmen, down to the Nile Delta. He seized the huge walled city of Damietta, tried to attack the Sultan, but was then defeated in an epic battle, was taken prisoner, and forced to pay a colossal ransom.
then got dysentery, which didn't kill him, but according to one source did mean he had to cut a hole in the seat of his trousers so that he had easy access when nature called, as it did approximately every 30 seconds. All of which got Henry's blood pumping. Even if Louis's crusade hadn't exactly worked out as intended, it still sounded like a grand old adventure. Perhaps even an opportunity for Henry to finally get one over on Louis by succeeding where he had failed. So in 1250, Henry took the cross in a big fancy ceremony, then started begging, borrowing, and taxing the money he needed to fight it. He redecorated rooms in the Tower of London, Winchester Castle, and Clarendon with paintings of scenes from crusades gone by, so that he was always looking at inspirational pictures of the Holy Land. He even got Queen Eleanor hyped up about this trip of a lifetime. She borrowed an official history of the First Crusade from the Master of the Knights Templar. In fact, Henry got so into his crusade planning that he started taking the lead in government in ways that no one had ever seen before. Suddenly, there he was doing his royal paperwork and scrutinising laws and financial plans. He even set a firm date for his crusade to depart, the summer of 1256, which would give him a good 6 years to get absolutely everything in order. So far, so good. But this being Henry, things didn't quite work out as intended. The first thing to go wrong in the 1250s is Gascony. For years, Henry's lived under the threat of a French king stirring up a rebellion there, then intervening to take it under French control. So as part of his drive to get a grip on his whole kingdom, Henry sends his brother-in-law and on-and-off best pal, Simon de Montfort, down there on a 7-year contract to take charge of government on his behalf and make sure no one gets any funny ideas. Unfortunately, when Simon arrives in Gascony, he gets a few funny ideas himself. He tries to run the place like he's the king, cracking heads together and getting a reputation among the locals as a tyrant who needs to be resisted at any cost. The result is that Simon makes a delicate situation so bad that by 1252, half the noble families in Gascony are in rebellion. Henry has to recall Simon, but typically, rather than punishing him, he pays him an overgenerous sum to buy him out of his contract. Then he goes to Gascony to try and sort things out, leading a very expensive and not especially productive military expedition, which gobbles up a huge chunk of the money he's raised for his crusade. Now, you could write off the whole business in Gascony as bad luck, but what happens next is pure lunacy. While he's in Gascony, Henry gets wind of a scheme by the Pope to carry out a spot of regime change in the Kingdom of Sicily. Now, there's a Plantagenet connection with Sicily. Think back to season 2, and you'll remember that Henry's uncle, Richard the Lionheart, once conquered it, and his aunt Joan was once the Sicilian queen. But that's kind of ancient history by now. Except not to Henry. In 1253-4, the throne of Sicily is up for grabs again. It had belonged to Henry's brother-in-law, the German Emperor Frederick Hohenstaufen, but he died in 1250. Since then, the Pope has been casting about for someone to take it over. The trouble is, taking it over will mean kicking Frederick Hohenstaufen's son Manfred off the island, which will in turn mean a very risky and very expensive military campaign. When the Pope offers Sicily to Henry's brother, Richard Earl of Cornwall, Richard simply laughs and says, "You may as well offer me the moon," and say, "Go on, just take it." Sadly, as we know, Henry doesn't quite have his brother's sense. In 1253-4, he figures Sicily would be a great place for his second son Edmund to rule. So he not only accepts the Pope's offer, but signs a contract binding him to conquering the place. It allows him to divert his crusade plans and money to do it. But if he doesn't, he gets excommunicated and England is placed under an interdict. As you can imagine, when he finally gets around to announcing that to the English nobles, there's a very loud, very large collective WTF. The English barons refuse point blank to pay any more tax to fund this craziness. And of course, they start bleating about Magna Carta to boot. But Henry persists in hoping he can pull this thing off, burning through credibility with the barons, his reputation with the Pope, and time that would be far better spent preparing for the actual crusade he wanted to go on. The final thing that goes wrong for Henry in the 1250s is his family. Ever since Henry got tangled up in affairs with his half-brothers from Poitou, known as the Lusignans, in the 1240s, there's been a major Lusignan faction at his court. Throughout the 1250s, the Lusignans have managed to wind up all the other barons, giving the impression, often correctly, that they're royal favourites and getting their choice of all the best lands, gifts and marriages that are always on offer when Henry is around. At the same time, Henry has also been suspected of being led around by the nose by another quote-unquote foreign faction at court, his wife's family, the Savoyards. They tend to rub people up the wrong way a bit less than the Lusignans, but they have their moments all the same. They're a major influence, for example, on his decision to go for the Sicilian crown. And to cap all that, in the 1250s, Henry also manages to lose the one family member he can usually rely on, Richard, Earl of Cornwall. When Frederick Hohenstaufen dies, as well as Sicily being up for grabs, there's also a vacancy for the job of King of the Germans, an elected post open to pretty much anyone who can afford to bribe the electors. Richard likes the idea of upgrading from Earl to King, and Henry helps him pay the necessary bribes. In 1256, Richard becomes King of the Germans. From now on, he'll only be around to support his hapless elder brother from time to time. Henry has basically used a big chunk of change to lose himself a powerful ally. But for Henry, it's just the same old, same old. The barons have been watching all this unfold with their heads in their hands. The country's falling apart. The people are starving in a terrible famine, there's unrest in Wales, and then Henry decides that the country's top priority is to have another crack at Sicily, with the barons footing the bill. It's the last straw. They pen a letter to the Pope, pleading that Henry has reduced England to an imbecilic state. Then they march on Westminster Palace, where we met them at the start of this episode, strong-arming Henry to go to the holiest shrine in the country and making him swear an oath to stop being such a Burke. Once Henry has made this oath, he begs the barons to give him until Christmas to get his act together. Thanks, but no thanks, they say. In fact, they have a better idea. They want to make Henry's oath official, and while they're at it, seize more power for themselves and kick his most annoying relatives out of the country. So in June 1258, the baronial glee team hold a parliament in Oxford. There they put forward a whole new system of government that's going to strip the king of way more of his power than Magna Carta ever tried to take from King John. Their reforms are known as the Provisions of Oxford, and they're incredibly ambitious. They put in place a council of 15 barons to run the country, along with a justiciar, chancellor and treasurer, who are responsible for the routine business of government. They put the king's castles in the hands of holders appointed by the barons. They also demand that Parliament meets 3 times a year to scrutinise the work of the council and make decisions about funding government. They state that justice is to be available to high and low-born alike. And to emphasise that point, the provisions are published not only in Latin, the language of the church, and French, the language of the aristocracy, but also in English, so that ordinary people can understand what's going on. In short, they transfer all practical control over royal government away from Henry III and into the hands of an independent governing body. It's not quite a revolution to overthrow the monarchy, but it's not too far away either. It looks like Henry's old friend Simon may have finally put the Plantagenets in their place. Warmer, sunnier days are finally arriving, as outside is calling. Factor is here to make sure that however busy you get, your meals are taken care of, giving you all the energy and time to enjoy that weather. Factor's fresh, never-frozen meals are dietitian-approved and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. So, no matter how busy you are, you'll always have time to enjoy nutritious, great-tasting meals. Treat yourself to restaurant-quality meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp and, oh yes, blackened salmon. Don't mind if I do. Make today the day you kickstart a new healthy routine and give yourself time to focus on what makes you happy. What are you waiting for? Head to factormeals.com/danjones50 and use code danjones50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next month. That's code danjones50 at factormeals.com/danjones50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next month while your subscription is active. The world's full of people celebrating their successes, but if the Plantagenets have taught us anything, it's that failing is much more interesting. So that's why I'm certain you're going to love the podcast How to Fail. The very brilliant Elizabeth Day invites guests on to talk about three of their biggest failures and what they've taught them about life. It's a great way to hear a new side to people you may think you know. Guests include Bernie Sanders, Phoebe Waller-Bridge, and Stanley Tucci. Give it a try. Find How to Fail wherever you get your podcasts. On a hot summer night in June, the moon lights the cobbled streets of Oxford. The Thames runs quietly past the townhouses and recently built colleges of Oxford University. Over the rush of the water, you can just make out the sounds of quiet footsteps and the clip-clop of hooves. A small group of figures lead their horses quietly from the stables, get to the edge of town and saddle up as silently as possible. Once they're all on their horses, they kick hard into the animals' flanks and gallop south in the direction of Winchester. This small band of horsemen are led by Henry's eldest son, Edward. Now 19 years old, a good decade older than his father was when he took the throne, Edward already knows his own mind much better than Henry ever will. After one look at the provisions of Oxford, he knew instantly he had no desire to sign up to the new regime. A regime that would render him heir to a hollow crown. So he and a small band of Lusignans decide to run for it. Or rather, to ride for it. Their escape is a bold move, though it's not clear what the end game might be. Soon enough, the barons get wind and chase after the party. Galloping through the night, they catch up with the wayward heir at Winchester Castle and barricade him inside. Edward holds out from inside the castle, but after 4 days, seeing no hope of rescue, he gives up. He reluctantly comes out and, bristling, swears to obey the provisions. The Lusignans, for their part, agree to leave the country. After that, the new government gets to work. Representatives of the council start touring around England, hearing complaints about abuses by royal officials that Henry hasn't handled. The barons get in touch with the Pope and start the process of wriggling out of the Sicilian nonsense. They finish turfing Henry's Lusignan family out of England. Then, most dramatically of all, they open negotiations with the French court of Louis IX to broker a peace that will fix the status of Gascony and all the other old Plantagenet claims to have an empire in France. Needless to say, this is all incredibly humiliating for Henry. His pet projects are being trashed. His power is being wielded by other people. And there's not a thing he can do about it. The barons don't mistreat him. He's allowed to live in luxury, go on pilgrimages, and potter around Westminster Abbey, where the building works are coming on at pace. But he's barely more than a king in name. It's like being a little kid again, being talked over by the grown-ups. At the end of 1259, the barons send Henry over to France to conclude the peace treaty with Louis IX. In some ways, Henry's happy to go. He quite likes Louis. He met him on the way home from his campaign in Gascony earlier in the decade, and the French king even sent him a pet elephant to keep his lions and polar bear company in the Tower of London. More on that in this week's subscriber episode. Quite what Louis makes of Henry is less certain. His patience is certainly tried when Henry takes an age to get from the French coast to meet him in Paris. It turns out Henry wants to stop in literally every church on the way to hear a mass. He takes so long that a despairing Louis orders all the churches on the road to be closed so he'll get a move on. Once his holy distractions have been shut down, Henry does eventually arrive, and the Treaty of Paris of 1259 is agreed. Under its terms, Henry gives up all the old Plantagenet claims to rule Normandy, Anjou, and Poitou. And he agrees that he holds Gascony only under the goodwill of the King of France, rather than as an independent ruler. In the minds of the barons who made this deal, this is the long overdue settlement of a very expensive issue dating back to King John's reign. But for others, including Prince Edward, but also Simon de Montfort, it's a total disgrace and a capitulation. Henry III is 52 years old when he agrees the Treaty of Paris. But he's never been treated more like a child. You can't say he doesn't deserve it, but for a Plantagenet king to be so thoroughly stripped of his power, and then forced to bend the knee to a king of France, even one who's given him an elephant as a present, is nothing short of a humiliation. Henry's a nice guy, but even he can't put up with this state of affairs forever. If he doesn't summon up a bit of the famous Plantagenet backbone, there'll be nothing left of his crown to hand over to his son. He has to find a way to overthrow the provisions of Oxford and put the troublesome barons who want to control him back in their box. Luckily, Henry has one last ally at his side who sees a way out of this mess. His wife, Eleanor, has been working on a plan. A plan that could return Henry to his former glory or risk losing everything. But that's for next time on This Is History. If you can't wait for more Plantagenet action, a reminder that the next episode is already out over on This Is History Plus, where you can listen ad-free alongside hours of subscriber-only content, where I chat with my producer about the Middle Ages. This time we look at what else was in Henry III's menagerie in the Tower of London, and find out what happened to the poor old elephant he got sent from France.
Do they know how to look after an elephant?
They don't know that it's a herbivore. So I think they feed it meat. I don't keep an elephant myself, but I wouldn't feed it like dog food. And it gets a bucket of wine to drink every day. So it's like the keto diet for the old elephant. To subscribe, go to Apple Podcasts and click Try Free, or head to thisishistorypod.com to start your free trial today.